Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Holistic Matters podcast. This is the Holistic Approach to Pet Care, and I'm here with certified veterinary technician Jody Griffiths.
Hello to all of our veterinary professionals and pet parents that are joining us today. Today, we're going to be talking with Dr. Donna Radetic and the role of the brain-gut microbiome connection in the health of our animals. Thanks, everybody, for joining us today. Today, we are going to be talking about the connection between the brain, the gut, and the microbiome, and how that applies to our pets. I'm excited to have our guest speaker with us today. Her name is Dr. Donna Radetic, and I'm going to turn it over to you, Dr. Radetic, if you want to give us a brief introduction.
Thank you. Thank you, Jody. So I was actually a general practitioner for many years, and I opened an integrative practice in the Berkshires of Massachusetts. When you do integrative medicine, everybody wants to know what to feed your dog and cat. And I was kind of clueless, like, it's tough. Those are difficult questions to answer. So I went back and did a nutrition residency where I trained at both Angel and Boston and that Tennessee. Eventually, I sold my practice and was asked to join faculty down at Tennessee, where I worked the nutrition service, but also started an integrative service at the University of Tennessee. So I was there as a professor for about 7 years, left there, and now I do independent consulting. I still do work with clients by referral, and I enjoy it. I really enjoy it. The connection of nutrition, supplements, health, kind of proactive approaches to dogs and cats. I think it's an amazing place to be right now.
And I think that's awesome because there are so many questions about nutrition and what the best foods are to be feeding our animals. And I think we all know that if you ask three people that same question, you're going to get three different answers on what the most ideal diet is. So I think it's really awesome that that's such a big interest of yours and obviously such a wealth of information. So today we're going to be really honing in on and focusing on the connection between the brain and the gut and the microbiome and how that affects the health in our pets in many different ways, whether it be from their mental health to their behavior to different GI conditions. And so let's start out by talking just a little bit about how the microbiome in the gut actually develops in cats and dogs.
Well, it's really interesting. It actually is in utero. Puppies and kittens actually start to develop their gut microbiota in utero. And then through birth, going through the birth canal, again, there's a kind of a population then set up. And we know that because cesarean puppies, kittens, and babies have different flora than ones that have been delivered more naturally. Then obviously during nursing, there's more buildup of that microbiota, and then weaning, and then as a young adult, they establish a adult microbiota. We know the siblings or the littermates will have similar microbiota for a period of time. We know that microbiota could be very stable for a long time. Where we start to see problems is going as they go on further. There can be disturbances in the microbiome, and especially with aging. Aging seems to really hit hard the gut and its flora, such that in humans and dogs, we're starting to realize that with aging, part of the what we call fragility of aging, you know, the lack of resilience, and that you'll see a decline in a healthy microbiome in those individuals. So it's quite a process.
And so what is the role? I mean, why do we want to pay attention to the health of the gut and to that microbiome? How does it play a role in the health of our cats and our dogs?
We're still learning. You know, at first we thought, okay, these guys are there and they probably help digest our food and that's all kind of interesting. But we're now realizing that they play a role in protecting our guts, dogs, cats, humans, protect our guts from pathogens. They indeed do help with digesting fiber, but from that digestive process and metabolism, they actually produce things like short-chain fatty acids that our gut cells, the epithelial lining of the gut, will suck up those metabolites and use them for energy. They also produce, interesting, they actually make neurotransmitters or precursors to neurotransmitters. And they play a very, very important role in the development and maintenance of the immune system. You know, 70% of the gut contains that lymphoid tissue, the gut-associated lymphoid tissue or GALT. And development and maintenance of that requires microbiota kind of talking back and forth with immune cells throughout life to maintain healthy, normal immune responses. So we're still learning, but it's a big part of who our dogs and cats and we are, our microbiome.
You said that we're still learning. Are there a lot of studies that are currently being done or have been done to give us these answers about the microbiome in our cats and dogs?
The research in this area is exploding because we're starting to realize without a healthy microbiota, we have what we call dysbiosis. And dysbiosis is when we have abnormal numbers or types or families of microbes in our gut. And dysbiosis is being associated with so many disease states. The obvious, of course, would be GI dysfunction, right? That's probably the first place we started to look. But then we started to realize, oh my, you know, this also affects our immune balance, right? And also our resistance to disease. It also now with this concept that the microbiome plays a role with neurotransmitters and gut function and communication to the brain, there's studies now looking into mental health and diseases in humans and also in dogs. So, you know, I tell people, you know, we grew up, or our veterinary career has been the age of antibiotics, right? With the discovery of penicillin, anti-bio, right? Not life. But what I think we're going to see and what we're seeing with the research is it is going to be now the time for the probiotics, supporting life. And that supporting life that's not about supporting our own body tissues. It's supporting our microbiome to support our body tissues.
Interesting. So as a nutritionist, what is the best way to explain how foods, because there are so many different foods that our pets are eating, whether it be dry kibble to prepared more fresh diets, raw diets, all the way down to the other end of the spectrum where pet owners are home cooking. How do all of those different types of foods affect the microbiome?
Well, we're in our infancy in that area. Basically, we know that different types of food, there are studies out there that have looked at canned, dry, what we call more processed foods. They've been heated. There's a lot of ingredients. The ingredients are processed before they even go into the final product. And then comparing them to raw, probably the least processed or more homemade-like diets, we do see differences in the microbiota of a dog eating a processed dry can versus a raw. We don't have long-term enough studies to know if that difference is beneficial, meaning is it better when you're on an ultra-processed, you have an ultra-processed microbiome versus a raw microbiome. We don't have that kind of information because that's going to require long-term studies. But if you want to extrapolate a little bit from what's happening in human nutrition, part of the reason in human nutrition we're being told to stay away from ultra-processed foods is because of epidemiological studies showing that ultra-processed foods, when they're brought into cultures that typically eat less processed, more healthy, fresh fruits, veggies, Mediterranean-type diets, when we bring in the ultra-processed, you know, McDonald's, all those kind of foods, we start to see more disease states. So it's starting to, if we extrapolate, my guess going forward is that we're going to have to start taking a hard look at pet diets as far as long-term health in our patients as well.
What is the connection between the brain and the gut?
Physiologically, it is the brain and the gut work through the nervous system, right? Parasympathetic, sympathetic, the enteric nervous system. There are hormones. There are all the neurotransmitters. So I think of it like an internet cable, just hardwired right into us and our dogs and our cats, where the brain is saying, hey, how's it going down there? How you feeling? How you functioning? what you eating today, right? And the gut's saying, oh, having a great meal, sending back some good stuff to you. Oh, I like that. You know, and it's a constant connection, and it's hardwired in us, you know, and it's hardwired in our dogs and cats where you, if you have GI issues, your gut's saying, hey, you don't feel good down there. I can tell. Yeah, I'm not feeling too good down there. And the signaling is interrupted. So almost like an internet, you know, like an internet wiring through nerves, through neurotransmitters, through hormones, through bioactive ingredients. I think that's mind expanding when you think about it, because it really then tells you how important this brain gut microbiome axis is, because if that hardwired internet isn't functioning correctly, it's going to have some whole body effects, isn't it?
So this makes me think of the dogs and cats that perhaps are having some behavior issues. Is the gut the first place we should be looking at?
In my opinion, and from what I'm reading and what I'm seeing, I'm going to say yes, because I think actually you have to think of it two ways. I think you have to think of it, if you have a dog with GI problems, you need to start thinking about the brain. And if you have a dog with behavior problems, right, you need to think about the gut. I don't think you can treat one without treating the other. And I think the sooner we as veterinarians recognize that relationship between the two of them, the better these dogs and cats are going to be. Because if you just focus on one, if we're just going to focus on behavior, and it's not wrong, sure, we need behavior modification, we might need drugs, we might need supplements for anxiety and all those kinds of things. But if that brain is not optimal, it's impacting the gut. And then as the gut kind of is bubbling and brewing, you might be thinking, okay, I'm getting my brain better. But if the gut's been bubbling and brewing, you're never going to really fix your internet connection, right? Mm-hmm. I don't care. The IT is failing, so to speak. So you've got to think of both.
So just think of all the animals that we're seeing, especially all of the dogs that are on medications for levels of anxiety. And like you said, their gut is just bubbling away and they continue to have ongoing GI issues, eventually being diagnosed with not only behavior issues, but then also maybe like IBD or something like that. It sounds like that's a connection that we might really be missing, and that if we would just be paying closer attention to that connection and to that axis, as you mentioned, then maybe we'd be able to help a lot of these animals and not make them just be dependent on medications all the time. Do you have any cases that you can think of off the top of your head where you have an example of this? An example of maybe they either had GI issues to start with and that was affecting their behavior, or vice versa?
You know, it's interesting. That's really how I got into this, because as a nutritionist, I get a ton of chronic enteropathies. Sometimes they're biopsied, sometimes they're not biopsied. They're at all different stages of chronic enteropathy. And chronic enteropathy, there's papers that define them as food responsive, or they're antibiotic responsive, or they're immunosuppressant responsive. And I get all of these. And to me, I started to step back and I started thinking, well, this is kind of a continuum. You know, maybe they start out as food and then they don't get treated appropriately, and then they need, or they're treated with antibiotics and then they're biopsied and they're IBD and immune. And then I had some clients who, you know, really became, you know, especially with telemedicine, you can see the dog in its home environment and you're watching the dog and the owner's talking and the dog barks. Oh, he always does that. And oh yeah, I'm working on this behavior, or he's, you know, he's got a lot of anxiety and phobias. So I started asking all my GI clients, you know, how's this dog's behavior? Is he normal, happy? No, well, he's good with this, not good with that. Oh, thunderstorms, phobias, anxieties, aggression, to the point that this is where I started digging into the human literature and really discovered this whole world of research with brain, gut, and microbiome. And even this morning, I have a young golden doodle. I mean, just turned a year. And I had this client with her other dog with cancer. So I had actually started working with her early on with her new puppy. And already at a year, this one-year-old golden doodle is having GI colitis breaks. And it's when mom leaves. It's when the routine is broken. chews on metally things, does, you know, paces, burpee, and then will have normal stool. And then goes back and something else happens and it's this pattern starting. And typically, you know, you want to make the mucus go away. It's had one, even had a little bit of blood one time. You want to just grab the antibiotic, you know, it's Metron puts out everything. My God. Well, there's studies. Yeah. Metron does help, but it really just destroys the gut flora and it has to come back and it takes a long time to come back. So, you know, I have to keep like tying my hands and tying my referring vet's hands and saying, I think we need to work this out. This dog is clearly has a disturbance in both its gut and its brain, and we've got to start treating both. So we are right now, we're working on behavior modification. I'm getting her working with the behaviorist. We are going to work at nutritional support and supplements for both gut, brain, her diet. Going to go at both of these and see if we can't improve that internet connection, that communication, and establish best communication between both the brain and the gut. Because otherwise, I think this dog with, you know, okay, we Metron and we're going to be good for a while. Then the dog's going to break again, break again. And every time it gets hit with either antibiotics or Tylosin or goes in, and if it hasn't progresses to a hemorrhagic GI and it's intravenous antibiotics, we're destroying the GI system. And my concern is then we're going to move out of the range where this dog can be stabilized and it's going to be eventually a biopsied IBD dog. So it's worth putting the effort in now. And this is important, I think, for general practitioners because they are the first line of defense. They're the ones seeing that one-year-old, you know, what we call stress colitis, right? They're seeing that, you know, inappetent little white dog won't eat this, won't eat that, you know, spits up yellow bile and also growls at the grandchildren, you know, and gets that fixed dilated pupil, don't come in my house look. You know, we're the first line of defense seeing these youngsters, and it's going to be up to us to embrace this concept of, you know, this is mental health and this is gut dysfunction and treating it appropriately and being respectful that this interconnection needs to be reinforced, not destroyed by heavy-handed use of antibiotics and a lot of the conventional medicine that we do.
Absolutely. And such, I mean, originally, I think years ago, we see this so much more often in the older animals, but now that fact that we're seeing it in so many of the young animals and it's setting them up, like you said, for this kind of repeated roller coaster on and off the medications and just frustration with the pet owners, but then also just think of how much that's stressing those dogs out, having accidents in the house or, you know, dealing with the discomfort of having all those GI issues. I mean, just the anxiety that's probably building for them. It's super sad, but I think that's why this information is so, it's so awesome because it's going to be educating more veterinarians and hopefully pet owners on an area to be looking at that maybe has been kind of overlooked or maybe not even thought about in the past. The attention that's being put on this connection, like the studies that are maybe being done right now, how is that going to equip the veterinarian? I mean, what are your thoughts on how this can help the veterinarian to better understand the lifestyle of their clients and the foods that they're feeding and the supplements that they're giving? How is that all kind of going to be helping the veterinarian to learn more?
Well, we have some studies, fortunately, never have enough studies, unfortunately, but we have some studies where they're actually looking at dogs with phobias and aggression and different behavioral issues and comparing their microbiome to healthy, mentally healthy dogs and recognizing dysbiosis in those dogs. And also, they're starting to sort out even what the exact imbalance is, maybe an overgrowth of a lactobacillus and what does that mean? And as we tease this out, I think what we're eventually headed for and what we're looking for are going to be specific treatments such as, you know, probiotic type treatments or prebiotics that will rebalance. And that will become, I think, more better approach for these dogs. But we've got a lot of work to do. There's also been a lot of work looking at medium chain triglycerides in seizures. And in some of that work, what was really interesting is they had a behaviorist in that study group who was looking at epileptic dogs. They started out with dogs who didn't respond to typical, you know, medications for epilepsies. They're resistant epileptics, and found that a large percentage of epileptic dogs have behavior problems. And when they were actually modifying diet with things like medium chain triglycerides and omega-3s and things like that, they were recognizing, again, different, you know, dysbiosis in epileptic slash behavior dogs versus normal, but then more normalization using things like MCD, omega-3s, where seizures became better and behavior improved. So it's, wow, we're scratching the surface. I mean, we're scratching the surface, but it gives me hope. It gives me hope that, and encourages me to try. I mean, how, you know, it's, we can name how many epileptic drugs we can lay on a dog. A little coconut oil. What do you think? How unsafe is a little coconut oil or maybe some omega-3s? How unsafe is that when you compare it to laying on drug after drug after drug? I think these are things we need to sink our teeth in and not be afraid of using them in our patients today.
Absolutely. So you mentioned probiotics, prebiotics. Let's switch gears a little bit. We know that this is an issue. We've identified that this potentially is something that we really should be paying attention to, especially if we're seeing dogs that are displaying behavior, mental health, dysbiosis, maybe even thinking about it proactively as well. How can we support these patients? What are things that we can be thinking about to help to address the issue? So you mentioned the pre and probiotics. How are those going to be beneficial? What are those going to do to help these types of situations?
So prebiotics are the fibers, and there's all the different fiber types out there, and they are actually what our microbiota will feed and metabolize to produce healthy short chain fatty acids, to be healthy, support healthy populations, more normal populations of gut microbiota. So playing around with different fiber types, and some of it is playing around. So how do I do it? So I might try, like my stress colitis dog, I've got her on a kind of an insoluble fiber, like a, almost like a cellulose, okay? And that's actually a bulk, and it helps with the gut motility versus a psyllium, which might be more fermentable, or maybe a mixed combination of soluble psyllium or and a cellulose mixes of fibers. So I'll play. And what am I doing? So what I'm doing is trying to decrease the bouts of colitis. And I've then the owner watching behavior. And those are the two things to monitor, because what I see in my patients when I play with prebiotics and probiotics, different types of probiotic compounds, different lactobacillus, bifidobacteria, all sorts. When I play with those, if my stools and colitis bouts decrease, my behavior will improve. My dog's resilience, ability to deal with mom leaving, changes in routine will change. And when stressors happen, we might get a little loose stool, maybe not as much mucus, or we turn around quicker. Okay. So what I have my owners doing is really being conscious of both monitoring stools, you know, we have fecal scoring and all that, and bouts, how often does it happen, but also the behavior. And that will tell me my fiber type, I'm doing it right, I'm getting it, and I'm not afraid to play. Again, compared to seeing this dog head into biopsy land and 9 million immunosuppressants, azathioprine, prednisolone, you know, you name it, cyclosporin, I think playing with a little bit of fiber and probiotics doesn't scare me at all. It's the way to go.
What about herbs? Are there any herbs that you recommend, especially for the ones that are showing a lot of stress and anxiety?
Yeah, definitely the adaptogen type herbs, you know, when you have to help. So to me, the prebiotics, probiotics, that's how I'm kind of taking this end of that communication of the internet is for the gut. But for the brain, using things like ginseng, licorice, you know, adaptogen type herbs, which will help increase resilience and stable. The other thing to think about too is I thinking about like hemp products, hemp oil products, playing with that endocannabinoid system, which is a key player in homeostasis. I mean, this dog obviously doesn't have homeostasis. It's here, it's there, it's here, there, there, right? So trying to find combinations of things like that that will work on the brain part of that internet connection. You have to do both. Treating just one is not going to work. And I think that kind of program is going to help this little girl not go into IBD land. That's what I'm hoping.
Mm-hmm. I've heard herbs termed as adaptogens. Can you explain what an adaptogen is?
An adaptogen is the types of herbs that help to improve the body's resilience and its ability to restabilize quicker and to deal with stressors. And, you know, herbs have been studied for thousands and thousands of years by different cultures. And, you know, I always tell people when people ask me about herbs, it's like, well, if I had 2,000 years to kind of study something and I was really good at collecting the data and transmitting the data over those 2,000 years, you get pretty good at knowing what does what, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what happened in a lot of these cultures. This was their medicine system. Their medical records were, this herb helps me to stay balanced. This herb helps me to fight off infections. This herb helps me to deal with stress, you know? And that information got passed along, and these herbs have been termed these adaptogens and are well known in the literature. And then, you know, what I always tell people don't realize is most of the drugs that we use today, about 90% of drugs, actually come from a lot of that old 2,000-year data, because you have a better chance of taking something like Siberian ginseng and look at all its components, right, and pull out one thing. And if you're a pharmaceutical company, you pull it out, and then voila, you have a new drug, and then you can patent and make a lot of money. But herbs, to me, have a whole effect, because they have multiple compounds that pharmaceutical company missed. So I get to use something that I think has a broader coverage in my patients than just singling out, you know, a Xanax or something like that.
And that makes me think, you know, kind of along the same lines, talking about using more isolated or synthetic vitamins versus providing the body with the food that is going to provide not only that particular vitamin, but just think of all the other components that the body is able to choose from when you're giving it something that's going to provide that kind of variety. So I think that kind of is a similar comparison. So speaking of vitamins and minerals, any particular vitamins and minerals that are beneficial for helping these types of patients?
Yeah, I always think when I'm thinking of brain and neurologic functions, I'm always thinking of B vitamins, you know, and, you know, they're classic. Everybody knows, you know, a cat doesn't get thiamine and you lose that cat. You know, we have some real issues. B vitamins are big players in the Krebs cycle, the whole metabolism of all nutrients and the production of energy. So we want to be looking at B vitamins, minerals, things like magnesium. You remember the old, you know, tetany, right? From magnesium tetany, calcium. You know, think of all those types of, you always go to the disease and then you can go back to the nutrient, right, that you need. So zinc and calcium, magnesium, selenium, all of these trace minerals. And what are they? They are often cofactors to some of the enzymes, again, for metabolism. Metabolism of general nutrients, yes, Krebs cycle, but also in production of neurotransmitters, you know, the serotonins and the gabapentins, the adrenal pituitary, hypothalamic axis, and all those hormones require these types of nutrients, which are very, very important. There are also nutritive supportive products, like, you know, when we talk about, the old term used to be glandulars, but some of these extracts of like adrenal, pituitary, thymus, things like that, that may have pro-hormones or active ingredients, enzymes, trace hormones, things that also support. You know, your comment about whole foods is exactly right. The body wants to be normal. You know, the body doesn't, you know, the brain and the gut don't wake up and say, hey, we just don't we don't want to have a good day today. You know, no, no, they want to have homeostasis. They want to have a good day every day, right? How you doing? I'm doing good. You're doing good. So the body is reaching and looking for those nutrients and looking for these nutritive supportive products, looking for these herbs and things in forms that they recognize. And it's our job to deliver those. And I think there's a lot of things we're not delivering those in the way we should with a lot of the commercial ultra processed foods and not reaching for good supplements that can provide better health for our dogs and cats.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Dr. Radetic. This was amazing information and definitely something that I think all pet owners and veterinarians should be aware of and paying attention to, because we all know that we see so many GI issues, so many behavior issues, that I really appreciate you being here with us today and just talking to us about it for a little while.
Thank you very much, Jody. I really appreciate the opportunity. I mean, it's kind of thinking out of the box, but it's where the box needs to go. You know, you're exactly right. These patients are out there, and as they progress, they get worse and they're harder to treat. So if we could start thinking of this earlier and applying this, and still even apply them to your more difficult cases, if you can improve a dog's behavior or a dog's GI, if you could get 20% on it, it's better than where it was, right? And I think this is really where we need to start thinking and heading to provide better care for our patients. Yes. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you, everybody, for joining us today, and we'll see you next time.
For more education focused on holistic veterinary care, visit holisticmatters.com for articles grounded in the expertise of veterinary professionals. That's holistic with a W.